this for a couple weeks. Are you going to be here next week?
Yes.
Yes. And we're talking to us today about complementarity in finite dimensional Hilbert space in the geometry that it suggests.
Okay. I push the home button.
Okay.
So I'll talk about something that I did together with Allside also. Actually, some time ago, that this was at least partly inspired by an NS, so I hope I can appropriate other basis functions, goats, workers, and a guy called Sauna, who wrote a very nice PhD thesis that I recommend in case you can be surprised. I won't talk about anybody else. So, the best of all equations is this one. And as you know, this leads to the conclusion that if you know everything about position, you know nothing about momentum. And then that can be summarized in the formula here. So this is the complementarity position and equation. And the question that that one can ask is how to make a finite dimensional Hilbert space. Then what is there an analog of this? So what you would be looking for are two sets of bases, called E1, E2, such that any element in one of the bases, scalarly product with any element in the other, should be a constant and independent of which vectors you're choosing. That constant you can show actually has equal to one of the square bend. So if two bases are positioned relative to each other in this way, they set the mutually unbiased bases. And this sort of captures them from complementarity. So the first person who looked for such bases and found them was Hermann Weyl in his book, 1920-something. And then nothing happened for a long time until Wurters noticed that, you see why later, that you can now ask how many such. So if I only had a pair of those, how many can you find in an n-dimensional Hilbert space? And it's actually easy to see from that later. The number has to be smaller than or equal to n plus 1. So then the question is, can one find n plus 1 such spaces?
Is it easy to see? How easy?
I'll give the argument during my talk at all. I usually plan my talks very badly so I don't get to the end, but this will be fairly early on, so I think we'll get to that. So given this upper limit, can you find n plus 1 such ones? And so the answer is that if n is a prime number, or in fact the power of a prime number, then the answer is yes, that's an explicit complexion, it's legal. If n is not the power of prime, the question is open, and in fact it's been open since it was first asked in the 1980s, which is a bit funny because you would expect that people go and ask something. So this is an open problem. Now, why would you be interested in finding n plus 1 amounts?
So are there fewer than it? There are just some, but not n up to n plus 1.
There's a lower bound. N, suppose n is P1, so you would make a prime number decomposition like that.
Okay.
Then the number of maps is actually bounded from below. That is to say, there are explicit constructions of P1 raised to the power of plus 1, such things. Okay.
Well, P is smallest, of
course. P1 is the smallest. And actually, there are some special dimensions where you can actually do better than that. There was an explicit construction this summer, right? something.
So it's the smallest P1 in the case?
Yeah, it's the smallest one. So we have okay, that's the point of the problem. So yeah, right. P1 is smaller than P2 is smaller than all the others.
That's what most of the statements, but when statement P1.
The statement is that somebody has explicitly constructed P1 raised to the power of K1 plus 1 max if n is this thing, where P1 is smaller than max and else.
Okay, that's but please look at it as a full set of n plus 1.
Yeah, that's all right. Okay. So, what is good? So, in particular, if n is 6, 3 max around. I would think that in n equals 6, I would sit down with this computer and just do it. But, okay. People have been sitting down for the past 20 years, and they haven't come up with the answer.
Is there any n for which people can do better than P1 K1 plus 1, or is that?
Yeah, as I was saying, there was a paper, but I actually don't quite remember. I should possibly find it in my references. There were two German guys who, for some special dimensions, there were somehow squares or something. They did a little bit better. I think it was Boykin and Beck, but I'm not quite sure. I can throw up.
Is there some n other than a prime power for which n plus 1 is known?
Pardon?
Is there some n other than a prime power for which
no.
you can achieve n plus 1?
No.
No.
Only for this case, there is a full set constructed that doesn't make the basis. So, why would you be interested in finding n plus 1 such things? There are actually a number of motivations. Wolters modulation has to do with tomography. And let's discuss that for the ordinary QB case first, right? So as you, in classical mechanics, let me just, it's probably worth mentioning this. So in classical mechanics, you have a phase space, and on this phase space, you have some probability distribution, and you can specify any region in this phase space, and you can ask what's the probability that the particle is in there. And the answer to such questions sort of returns T. Now, in quantum mechanics, it doesn't work like that, you know. There is a state, which is a density matrix, and that density matrix will tell you things like the probability that the particle has position between such and such is something. So the state will give you the probability. In fact, what this means is that the state will give you the probability that the particle sits in this strip, and in all similar strips, or particular strips. Similarly, you can find the probability that it has a certain momentum. So, in strips like this, rho will also return back. For strips like this, rho will return back for you the probability distribution. Now, you know what I'm going to say next, thing that linear, sometime in the 30s, produce a function of Q and T, which can be constructed from rho, or conversely, if you know W, the linear function, then you can construct rho. And this function is such that if you integrate that function over such strips, you get the relative probability that this distribution that you should. The marginals come out correctly. You can then ask, suppose I know the marginals. So this will produce only marginals, which are probability distributions in Q and in P. And suppose I know those, will that give me rho? The answer is no. However, what was found in the 1980s, I think, by a married couple called Bertrand, both of them, is that if you can introduce all that linear quantum optics rho taking for quadratures, these are things someone can actually measure in the quantum optics context. So this is slightly more general observables, and they will return back probability distributions that are sort of say connected to scripts with arbitrary solve like that. And if you have many pockets of your system, you can measure all these probability distributions for a sufficient number of those. Now, this function W here is actually uniquely defined by the requirement that it should return the correct marginals for all such strips. Since you can measure the marginals, if you have, you can supply the performance of your system, or if you can measure enough of them in practice, you can actually reconstruct the linear function and hence the step. You all seen such pictures of reconstructed linear functions. So, yeah.
So, knowing all the quadratures is sufficient for you to cover the dead set. Is it necessary? Can you get away with it?
Yeah, I think, no, I think that was the content of the work by this married couple that I mentioned at home. That actually, the question seems to have been raised by Paul at first. I mean, if you know these two markers, then you reconstruct the same. The answer is no. And as I understand it, you need all those. And then you do something called an inverse Radon transformation to reconstruct that.
For
interdimensional,
for the interdimensional Hilbert space, so if you P and Q from a plane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For this case?
Yeah, this is this
case. Yeah. However, if it was a different case, then you might not need all.
No, I was going, this was a thing, which is sort of serves as a motivating thing here. For. Now, what's the corresponding statement for these finite dimensional Hilbert spaces? Let's suppose that we have n plus 1 maps. Okay? Let me assume that I have the map. So I have n plus 1 maps. And what Wouters did in his original paper on this thing was that Wouters showed that if you have n plus 1 maps, then you can construct the Wigner function that lives on something called a finite affine plane. And the analogy between that story and this story is essentially perfect, except that this story is much simpler given the mouse. And this is what I will try to make next. So, suppose for convenience that n is 2, in which case these things are not existing. In general, of course, let's see, in general, n plus 1 mouse. That's equivalent to having n times n plus 1 projectors so if this index labels which map you're in and this index labels which projector in the given basis you're looking at and there are n times n plus 1 of those, if I want to I can use collective index omega. So omega goes between 1 and this thing, and so on plus n. And if I'm not given a state, a row, this means that I have this many probabilities that can be returned by projective measurements. Now I can nicely arrange these probabilities in the following fashion. In an n squared array, so in this case I have a 2x2 array, and actually the 2x2 case is actually first done not by Wouters but by Feynman. So let me try to sort of draw what happens. What's this supposed to correspond to? Well, the idea is that there will be a function of this on this array, omega ij, where ij labels where in the array you are. So Wouters or Feynman in this case constructed a function of these four points, or it should be n squared points, such that so here's w1, w2. If you now sum this function, like on these two, like you sum here and here, and you get the probability that you can call p 1 1, and here you get p 1 2. Okay? And these are two of the probabilities that are supposed to be returned by the state. And then you can sum in this direction instead. So here you get p, let's say, 2 1, p 2 2. And well. However, there are actually, in this case, 6 probabilities. So the other probabilities will obviously get by summing some here. And you sum along this line. B. Oh, I did it wrong. Okay. 21. Okay. So, in other words, we've just constructed a function, call it the finite state Wigner function or something, of on an n squared array, such that when you sum according to some path, which in this case works out like this, you recover these probabilities by summing. Yeah, you recover these probabilities. And we also showed that the converse, if you know all these probabilities, you can reconstruct the Wigner function. And there's a simple recipe, I'll come to that later, for our given figure. So this is how the state tomography is supposed to work. I hope it didn't confuse you. Yes?
I did, but perhaps. And then the analogy you're drawing, is it true that if I take the eigenstate of any one of those quadratures, so if you wrote on the top part there, the overlap Q and P is whatever virtue of X, if I take the eigenstate of any one of those quadratures and ask for its overlap, with a position eigenstate, it would also be 1/√2π.
You know, this is precisely what Sandro Trotsky meant that I started thinking what I would say today, and I didn't have the time to check that.
Uh-huh.
There's a bit of structure there which isn't present there. It just occurred to me that I didn't know the answer to that question. Sorry, I should know. In fact, for such a large audience, someone should know.
I think Phil Wooters once said that AR and UK and Vice basically tell different quadratures.
Isn't it surprising, isn't it? They're very close.
Yeah, there's something funny going on in the limit that they become the same, but there's already something funny going on because they don't even live in the open space. So.
Yeah, it's a bit embarrassing, but at least I had to realize that I should have known the answer to that question. There's a bit of firm structure here which doesn't exist there, I should say. No, it was like matrix. So I am not completely sure.
Isn't the opposite way? There's more structure there than necessarily there.
Well, of course, we can always argue these cases back and forth. So, probably yes. Anyway, let's look at this, this thing here. What we actually did was that we constructed something that's known as a finite affine plane. So this is an affine plane. You know what an affine plane is. An affine plane is doesn't have to be finite, but it can be. An affine plane is something that everybody knows what it is, except that's all the expression. So it's like a penis, right? We set down a set of axioms. We have a set of objects that we call points. And we have lines that are subsets of the set of all points. That's what a line is, obviously. And then we set down the following axioms. One, given 2 points, there will be a unique line obtaining these points, or going through these points, as that one point really I'm saying. Axiom 2, this is a parallel axiom, so you just keep it strong straight. If the point does not lie on a line, or is not contained in a line, actually, then there is a unique line through it, the point not intersecting the given line. So this is what happens here, right? Here's a line, here's a point, here's a unique line. And then there's some idiotic external requirement, like there exists at least 2 lines. We need that to avoid that. So this is what an affine plane is. And so here's one affine plane, the one we're all familiar with. But this is actually also an affine plane, you see. To take any 2 points, say this one and that one, and there's a unique line going through them. Given that line, you pick any line, any point from it, there will be a unique line on this one that doesn't set the original. And this works. Of course, these two lines, I should point out, do not intersect, so that's no problem there. Okay. So what I actually have here, remember that these two things were actually associated to a basis, and now you see that the basis is somehow associated to a family of parallel lines. This is also associated, well, those are also associated to a particular basis, and they're actually associated to a set of parallel lines. Okay.
So those two orange lines are parallel. Even though they don't look like.
Yeah, exactly. Just to avoid. Now these things work nicely also. Let's try. So this was actually a finite affine plane with only n the two squared points. Now let's see if we can construct something on a 3x3 array. So if this would be somehow an affine plane of order 3, finite, and yeah, it will work into here also. Here's one parallel line, here's one parallel line, here's one parallel line. There's another set, another pencil of parallel lines. And, okay, now pick these two points, they determine a line. Pick any point not on that line, there'll be a unique line, not intersecting the original, it will actually go like this. And then there'll be another one that goes like this. We have three parallel lines like that. And now if we pick these two points, I should pick some line between them, and yeah, it is like this one. And then you go like this. And so here you have no less than four pencils parallel lines. So that's a finite affine plane.
You said that two points of the line itself determine the third point, or is that
what did I say? The two points will determine the line beneath.
Okay, so if you have the two points, say the blue line joined on the diagonal, you take the first two points, or two points, and how does that determine the third point?
You see, that, well, oh, you know, how do you know that this line, but this point is faulty on that line?
Yeah.
That's a tricky question. Because my next step was to emphasize that the fact that we were able to construct so nicely a finite affine plane with only nine points, it's not as simple as that in general. This is about the last case that you do just standing up. In fact, it must be emphasized that a finite affine plane is a combinatorial structure described in all decent textbooks on combinatorics. A frightening subject. Mathematicians have proved the following. There's something called an affine plane. All the finite affine planes have an order of order n, has n squared points. These are general theorems. There are n points. You can shape on the two examples again on each line. There are n squared plus n lines divided into n plus 1 pencils of n parallel lines each. Okay? And at least you can see that we're already throwing up some of the numbers that I thought I had written down. So this is actually the number of pure states you have in a complete set of maps. This is the number of maps. This is the number of forms. I mean, states. Then the question is, this is somehow related to this question. You realize that soon if you find u is for higher n, that's very such a question. For which n do finite affine planes exist? That's the question. And that question was actually raised by Leonhard Euler in 1780 or something like that. He failed to solve it, or n equals 6, he was unable to find an example. Actually, for if n is a prime number or the power of a prime, none of that exists to find a finite type. If n is 6, the answer is no. So Euler failed to get that one. It was done with a, so to say, computer search by hand by Frenchman in 1900. It took some time. Then there is a theorem that says that if n is 4k plus 1 or 4k plus 2, and if n is not the sum of two squares, then again the answer is no. That actually covers n equals 6 case. If n is 10, the answer is no. That's the state of the art modern computer. That's an extremely massive calculation. And that tells you something basically about computers. So computers are exactly this much better than humans. So the first case now, which is not covered by either this or that, is n equals 12, and that's open. And it's been open since 1780. Now, if you go back here. Okay, that's a little bit more detail there, but it sort of, well, it otherwise looks similar, and the fact that there's more detail there, maybe that there are 200 more years.
Question. Well, how did you find the order of the
French here? Pardon? How did you find the order of the French here? Well, I tried to sit down and construct with a finite number of quotes. Not fine planes, so combinatorial structures are enough. You remove the problem. Okay, for some n, and that n is now going to be the order of the
So there's not obviously a direct connection between the affine planes and the MUVs.
That's precisely my question. Yes, sir.
But I thought you wouldn't have resolved, and you have a theorem that says you always have at least P1 to the K1 plus 1 of the MUVs. And here you have theorems that say you have zero.
There's detailed finite structure here. That's my argument, but there is no obvious connection. Yeah. I mean, it's just that the fact that, and that's precisely the question that also I might try to answer. Is there a direct connection between these two problems? There's actually even more, you can make the list even more compressive. For instance, for n equals 6, we know 3 mups. Now, mathematicians who do this kind of thing phrase the problem of constructing affine planes in terms of having more nuclei of all the Latin squares. And the statement is that you have, so to say, 2 plus the number of mutually orthogonal Latin squares equal to the number of tensils in the affine plane you're trying to construct. And the number of Latin squares you can construct for n equals 6, you cannot even construct one pair of mutually orthogonal Latin squares. That sort of corresponds to having 3 maps, 2 are for free. Just 2 maps are for free. And you can find the third, yeah. And you can construct the Latin square and then down. So there's even more impressive detail here. But there is no, actually, assuming I get to the end of the talk, which I'm not sure about, because I rarely do, I would actually probably rather tend to argue that. So we did something on this question, and after the. I mean, it's difficult to be sure, but I rather think not. I think these are two independent. On the other hand, for the state determination part, of course, we need the tomography part to be dynamic. So anyway, my question is, are these two problems the same? So to discuss this question, I propose to use the following. So instead of thinking in terms of a Hilbert space of dimension n, let's place ourselves in the vector space of trace 1, Hermitian, and maybe so in the vector space of dimension n, centered at the maximum state, that's the origin. Dimension of that vector space is equal to n squared minus 1. And that is which is not trivial here, n minus 1 times n plus 1. Of course, I have another notion of distance in this vector space, so the distance between two matrices squared are defined as negative 1 half times the trace. So this is an Euclidean space. And all the pure states, so in particular the projectors here in the mouse, let's see, I have n times n plus 1 projectors. If I have a set of maps, I have a complete set of maps, homographically complete set of maps. I have n times n plus 1 projectors, k omega, and they actually sit as I have given, this gives you n, the equal number of points on a sphere, defined by the phase of the matrices UV1. So, in other words, the picture is. Well, we keep that one there. I have just enough space. So the picture is that we have a sphere in this n times n square minus one dimensional space centered at the maximum mix state. And all these projectors in the maps sit on the surface of that sphere. And that means if you now take the convex hull of that, you get the convex polygon. And the idea was that we should look at the, we should try to understand that convex polygon to see, well, if there was anything to see, that was a problem. So let's see. In this vector, well, I suppose we'll not use it anyway. So suppose you give them a basis. In a given basis, you'll find that the trace of two projectors picked from the same basis is actually equal to zero, as you know, when k is not equal to L. And if you translate that into this Euclidean geometry, this doesn't mean that they are orthogonal, because we're actually, this trace one condition means that it doesn't work quite like what you used to. They're not orthogonal. This actually means that you have a regular simplex. The basis is n minus one dimensional regular simplex in this vector. So that's what one basis gives you. So here's the basis n plus 3 state. And here's the maximum mix state. And here's the sphere I was talking about. And here's a two-dimensional cross-section. And you see that you get the regular simplex there. So if you have two different bases that are mutually unbiased, then you can work out from this scalar product condition that I gave you that take any one of those, n one of those, then you get 1 over n, and again the scalar product works a little bit funnily because our matrix has space 1. This actually means that the corresponding vectors here are a problem. I can give you the details, but they are, I can show you what scalar product can really work on with the sort of or believe me. So, so this means that we can draw a decent picture of this polynomial in any dimension. Because we already know enough to see exactly how it works. For n equals 2, and I guess it was an S who started this business. So for n equals 2, let's draw this polygon. So I have this sphere, it's now sitting in 2 square minus 1 dimensional space, that is to say just it's 3 dimensional space. And the mutually unbiased basis now sit as follows. So one is the standard basis, like this. North and south pole, and then somewhere sits at the west and east poles. And well, I mean in the x direction. And then there's some that sit in the y direction, something like this. If you take the convex hull of that, you take the convex hull to get this polytope, and you get some that looks like this. You actually get the regular of that E domain. So here's this polytope for n equals speed. And sure enough, I mean, so here's the maximum mistake. This vector and that vector are orthogonal. For n equals 3, you draw the picture as follows. So the first map is a regular simplex centered from row star. The second map, there are actually 4 of them, also is also an orthogonal, is also a regular simplex centered at row star. But they actually sit in 2-dimensional subspaces now that are totally orthogonal. So each vector in one of these subspaces is orthogonal to any vector in the other. And since there are now 4 maps, there really are 4 maps, you actually get 4 regular simplices sitting in totally orthogonal planes like this. And that gives up the 8-dimensional space. And then you take the convex hull of the corner. You can easily go on. In general, you're going to get n plus 1 simplices of dimension n minus 1. And these n minus 1 dimensional subspaces should be totally orthogonal to each other. So, for instance, if I draw the case n equals 4, I get 4 tetrahedra, 5 tetrahedra, and then I get set of things in all 2 if I want to. So, this is how the polygon is constructed. And obviously, this works in any vector space of dimension n squared minus 1. The thing I'm leaving out here, of course, is the question whether these corners actually represent fewer states. So I have to remember that the points in my vector space are really density matrices, or matrices, and these matrices have a spectrum, and I have to know whether all the points in the polytope are positive matrices, and that's a fit part. Geometrically, I mean, this couldn't go wrong here, because the entire outer sphere consists of fewer states. Positive. But in general, for n equals 3, you see what happens, right? You have this sphere in an 8-dimensional space, it's actually a 7-dimensional sphere. Now, there's only a very small subset of that 7-dimensional sphere that actually corresponds to quantum mechanical projectors. So there's actually some 2-dimensional set, that's CP2, of states, somehow, it's like a tennis ball somehow. So the pure states, pure quantum states, actually have dimension 4 in this case. So it's a very small subset of the sphere. So now if you have this convex polytope, and you want to ask, are the corners really mutually unbiased spaces in hyperspace? What you have to do is you have to place this polytope so that all the corners are on the surface of the sphere, and then you have to literally rotate this polytope, and then suddenly, by some fantastic accident, all the corners lie in this very small polytope subset. That's kind of difficult to find on that.
Can you explain that n equal to 2 picture in it and then you get the 8 points?
Yeah, okay, you know the rock ball, of course. This is the rock ball, okay? And these are the these are actually the eigenspaces of sigma z. Okay. And these are actually the eigenstates, the blue ones are the eigenstates of sigma x, and the yellow ones are the eigenstates of sigma y. These are three community environment spaces. So I just place them where they should be on the rock wall and then I make a promise to get the whole.
Your functionality of the different plane species of synthesis.
Pardon?
Your functionality of the plane species of synthesis.
No.
Is that sufficient to guarantee that the other is 100N?
Well, okay, let me give you the formula which I have somewhere. What you have to do is you have to construct the scalar product. What I actually have is an ultra distance, right? But I've imposed the condition that the trace of the matrix is this one. Okay, so the usual scalar product won't do. So what I actually do is that I define the scalar product in this vector space by, I think it's called polarization, so I take 1/4 of the distance squared between A plus B and the point I've selected to be the origin, namely the maximum mix state. And then I subtract B squared I A minus B with distance 2. I mean, so that's the norm square. You want to give distance to the origin. And I work that out. And I find that the scalar product of two matrices as a result of this calculation is actually equal to the trace of A times B minus 1/n. So if the trace of A and B is 1/n, they are orthogonal. And so if I take two mutually invariant spaces, I get 1/n now because it's used.
Right.
So it goes like that. And then you see why I didn't want to be with that beautiful.
But this is just a
Hello.
This is just a standard metric on the space of The only thing that you've done really is you've chosen the origin to be at the
exactly.
So orthogonal means that the angle between the vector joining them to the total of the
matrix. I've done this funny trick exactly because I want to talk about all the orthogonal planes. I really want to scale a product. I want to use the word orthogonal. And this is the precise meaning for it. Now, okay, so this convex polygon was supposed to have something to do with the affine trait. So let us address this question. For one case where we mediate singly what the polygon is completely right. So the fun thing about this is that if you count the number of corners in this polygon, is equal to n squared plus n, which is precisely the number of projectors you have to play with if you have a complete set of maps. So the idea is that the corners of the polytope actually correspond to lines in the affine plane, because remember, in this tomographic construction, the lines were actually associated with projectors. Okay. The question is, these points that Wouters or Feynman just drew out on their hands, what are they supposed to be? So we need n squared something, which we're going to call points. So we need to somehow associate n squared something on this polytope and call them points. So in this case, we need four things. We can count the number of faces here. And it's clearly eight faces, so that doesn't quite work. Now what you can do is that you can paint every other for any of us too, it's easy. Just paint every other face flat. So it's one face planted. And I do them like this so that they never meet each other along probably along an edge. And where does this thing sit open? So now I painted four faces flat like this. And then my suggestion is that somehow each of these black faces should correspond to a point in my affine plane. For the octahedron, that level is giving me the right number. And also, you see these axioms. So if I take two points, so two black faces, they should determine a unique line. Okay, that's obvious. They will always intersect in a unique corner, and that's the line. So two points determine the line. Then if a point doesn't lie on a line, let's see, if a point doesn't lie on a line, so here's a line, and here's a point that doesn't lie on it, because it doesn't touch it, then there should be a unique line through it, through what? Through the point, so one of these lines, that doesn't intersect if a point doesn't lie in line, then you need, well, then let's put it let me rephrase it. So the idea is that two lines always intersect in a point, but unless they happen to be parallel. That's easier, although it's not so tight. So if I take any two lines, they will always intersect in a point, this point, unless they happen to be parallel, in which case there is no face one can associate. So it works. Maybe it didn't inspire confidence, I think. It's actually a bit difficult to remember the basics of points and so on. But it works. The question is, how does it work in general? So seeing how it works in general, we have to understand the polytope in general a bit better. Understanding a polytope always means have a look at the structure, its face structure. Okay. So let's do that for n equals 3, even though as an example, to have these four total of polynomial products. And what's the face now? Let's see. So as soon as n is bigger than 2, there are lots of interesting things. For instance, all edges, all lines connecting to corners, are extremal, meaning they sit at the boundary. This is only for n and bigger than 2, and it's still the same. There are actually n to the power of n plus 1 facets. A facet, of course, is a face with a maximum dimension. So let's see what that is. So a face with a maximum dimension, you get that by taking all except one of the points in the simplex. And then you do the same for all the simplexes. You pick every point in the simplex except one that you leave out. That's what I'm going to give you, since there are n possible choices here. And if you put n plus 1 times, that's what I'm going to give you n times n theta to the power of. So the facet is actually the convex hull of the points selected in a way. This is the highest dimensional case you can get, lying on boundaries. I give you a formal proof that this is a massive.
Is this a 7-dimensional hyperplane? Yes, we are 8 dimensions now.
We're in 8 dimensions, so this is a 7-dimensional thing, yeah? This is a convex hull of 8 points. Remember that actually all the time the maximum is state sitting in the middle of the center of the central mass. Opposite to each facet, there's something that I'm going to call a point face. I call that point face. That's actually, so I pick one point on each simplex. That in itself forms a regular simplex, that doesn't matter so much. And eventually, what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a selection among these point faces to get the points I have to play. To make sure that I've really got it right, that these are extremal faces and so on, let me remind you that an affine functional. That sounds nice, that sounds frightening. But an affine functional is just a family of parallel hyperplanes, right? What I'll do is the following. To each point face, I'm going to associate an operator, that is to say a vector with phrase 1. An operator with phrase 1, that is to say a vector in this vector space, as follows. For each point face, an alpha now runs between 1 and n squared, since there are that many point faces. I define it as follows. So the vector is actually sort of the difference between the matrix and the matrix for the maximum bit state. And then I sum over the point face of all the projectors, or all these corner matrices, let me call them corner matrices, of all these vectors. Okay? And if I work, shuffle that one around a bit, this actually is sum over the point phase. All the corner matrices sitting in the point phase minus. So, good point phase, I can evidently associate such an operator. And I can get the properties, remembering that phrase, well, I know the phrases between the p's, so to say. So I can easily check now that phrase A alpha equals 1 by construction. And I can also check that actually the phrase of such a thing squared is n. That means that they all sit on the same distance to from the origin. And I can now define an affine functional by taking the trace of such an operator associated to the point phase with rho is now a generic name for all the matrices in my vector space, so it's not yet a fancy matrix. And I put that equal to the constants, and that defines the hyperplane in this vector space. And using the properties of the piece, it's now actually easy to prove, so sit down and do it, that this hyperplane, one of these hyperplanes, namely that one given by phrase A row 0, goes through this facet. And there's another parallel hyperplane in the same family, defined by phrase 1. Okay. So this is a nice way of saying that this point phase really sits opposite the facet. And there's this nice sort of thing that not but at least they have something to begin to play with. And this is also a formal proof that these phases are extreme parts. Now, my next idea is that I want to make a selection of n squared these point phases. And these selected point phases are going to serve as a points in my affine plane.
There's a question. So you show that those point phases are extreme, but is it clear that those are all the phases, all the extreme phases?
No, they're not all the extreme phases. Okay. They're the ones I can use. So. I want to start to make complete lists of phases of things that will also stop me because it's almost empty. So I'm going to select n squared point phases such that, and then I can call them, these things I can index like aij instead of a alpha if I want to, because n squared of them. And I want to choose as such a phrase of one of them. The other one is equal to n, alpha, alpha, beta. That actually means that this forms, this is going to form, this actually means that this is these points here forms a regular n squared minus one dimensional simplex. And the question is, if I can do that, geometrically what I'm doing is that I'm asking for a regular simplex which is oriented in a very special way. So I can actually, by printing it a bit, actually, I can inscribe it into this polytope so that the corners of the simplex sit exactly right in the middle of one of the point faces or one of the passes. So the geometrical problem is to inscribe a regular simplex in this polytope. And the question is if this can be done. And it's this question now that leads to the affine planes. Since I actually control these traces via the piece, now it's 5 o'clock, and explaining a combinatorial problem in 3 minutes is not going to be a success. But let me try to explain why this is a combinatorial problem. So, I can rewrite this as remembering how these things were defined. Like that, I move the 1 the left-hand side of set. So this is phrase A alpha alpha beta. The one that I want to read is plus 2 plus n, and that's going to be equal to the sum over all of the x in one form places, and it should be replaced, of course, times beta omega in the other. And if I sit down and look at this equation, so these traces here can be three things. If these p's sit in different symplices, each set of these terms is 1 over n, if they sit in the same simplex, they contribute either 0 or 1. Now, so all the numbers are positive or 0. Now when I try to work this out, to see if I can get this with n delta alpha beta here, if I can get that, I reach the following conclusion. Each pair, well, this conclusion will give you the right answer when we compute that. Each pair of selected point faces must have exactly one P creator or coordinator. And since I'm going to select n squared things, and each pair of these things that I select must have exactly one P component, I now have a combinatorial problem. And that combinatorial problem, when you try to solve it, you realize is exactly equivalent to the combinatorial problem of finding a finite affine plane over n. So that's where the affine plane comes from, in a way. The affine plane arises from this point of when I try to inscribe a regular simplex in a particular way. And notice that, so I arrive in this way at the affine plane. So I can do this construction if and only if the affine plane exists. I can use any affine plane. So the affine plane that people have been using in quantum mechanics literature so far have been affine planes constructed from something called finite fields. There are plenty of examples that are not constructed from affine fields. Now, if you give me this polytope, and if you give me an affine plane constructed any way you like, I can produce for you an affine plane if these corners happens to be mutually invariant spaces. Everything in Wood's papers with the convention, etc., would go through without the finite element, but without the finite fields. Yeah. Well, I'm usually in the hands of sort of like something when I think the time is up. I think it is. So,
you have like 5 minutes.
I do. Okay. So I can do two things. Either I can try to explain now where the Wigner function comes from. Let me do that. So I did this. Now, where does the Wigner function come from? So the Wigner function arises spots. So we have now selected n squared a's, and they have this nice property. It's like that they're a nice basis for the real of un, and there are plenty of connections in this story. And the algebra theory that I haven't had the time to talk about, and this method which I don't understand either, but anyway, so we now define the Wigner function as follows. The Wigner function, remember, should be as to each point in the affine plane, you should assign a value, and that's the Wigner function. So with each point, we've associated an operator A, I, J, and you define given quantum state, rho, you define the Wigner function like that. And since these things actually form a basis, you can easily invert this. So if you know the Wigner function, you know the density. Now, the probabilities that people actually measure associated to a line, like this one, is actually the sum over the line omega of the values of the weakness I'm containing at these three points. And so this we can write as 1 over m times sum over the line planes from a I j. And now we know what a I j is. A I j was given as the sum of projectors, namely the yeah. So if I may continue this calculation, this is actually going to be, if I now insert that expression for A here, so it's trace, 1 over trace, and then I trace over all points, so, okay. I guess I missed something out because there was some 1 sitting there, so it's minus place. Again. So the linear function associated with this point, that point, and this point. However, the operator is actually equal to the sum of all the lines that pass through that point. So what I'm actually summing here is the entire pencil of lines going through that point. And now we say that in each of these terms, all of the points are included, and there's one special point that's included more often, so to say. So if you do that, you find that if you first subtract out here now all these projectors at the third, I mean, all these projectors, obviously, you get a unit from that. And these things here, this thing, and this thing are weighted more heavily. This was not a very good explanation, but if you sort of continue like that, you'll find that this is equal. If you do this calculation, you find that it's like precisely in the place of the relevant projector, so which is possible. You can also see, if you sum all the probabilities, I think it's better to stop here, because I think I'm getting more used to it. Anyway, one can play the game and one can understand the topographic state, which is actually very nicely in 10 minutes, almost. What we haven't at all understood is how to rotate this polytope so that all its corners actually become pure states. And we try to think of this by trying to see, so if this doesn't work in some dimensions, it must somehow be the case that either this polytope, for this, in these dimensions, or the set of densities, the body of densities, must somehow be skewed. One of these structures must somehow have some peculiar feature for prime numbers, say, which means that it doesn't work for non-prime numbers. And we looked at various properties of both the body density matrices and the polytope to see if there's anything that goes quick for prime numbers, I mean just in terms of like computing areas and volumes, your volumes, and see whether the largest ball is an ellipsoid or a sphere and things like that. And there's absolutely nothing we can see that goes quick to prime numbers. So about the main question here, we know absolutely nothing that other people don't know already. If I should make a guess, however, I think that the message of this is A, the problem of mutual and biased spaces and the existence of alpha planes, if there is a connection, it's at some very deep level, there is no direct connection. And the second one is that if I should make a guess, I would guess that the map exists. I mean, because I don't see anything that means alpha planes.
Sorry,
your
last sentence.
Okay, if I should make a guess based on what I know, whether the maps exist for all dimensions, then I would say that having looked for things that are special and geometrical point of view for prime numbers, having found nothing, I must conclude that based on what I know, I would guess that they always exist. the fact that people haven't found them, okay, remember that the Alpine Plain question has been sort of open since 1780, so the fact that people haven't found them on their own computers in 20 years doesn't mean that very much.
Questions?
I have a question. Maybe it's too general. So you can do tomographic set of projectors which are not mutually biased, right? Mm-hmm. But they're still tomographically complete. So is there some interesting
part?
You can start with a set of projectors which are not mutually biased.
Yeah.